Today on Against the Grain, it's an unlikely book to take America by storm, a 700-page work of economic history by a French academic. But Thomas Piketty's Capital in the 21st Century has proved to be a book for our times, explaining both the extreme inequality that characterizes our world and drawing some bold and empirically backed arguments about the inherent tendencies of the capitalist system. I'm Sasha Lilly. We'll air an almost hour-long conversation that I had with Thomas Piketty. That's coming right up. From the studios of KPFA in Berkeley, California, this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. I'm Sasha Lilly. The French economist Thomas Piketty's book has caused an enormous sensation, perhaps unrivaled since the writings of right-wing economist Milton Friedman in the 1970s. Capital in the 21st Century, a work whose title clearly evokes the earlier weighty book by Karl Marx, has rocketed to the top of bestseller lists in the last several months and has been debated on opinion pages all over the country. In it, Piketty makes the argument that over centuries, economic growth averages 1 to 2%, while the rate of return on capital investment, such as stock, has averaged, with some notable historical exceptions, 4 to 5%. The difference between the two rates, growth abbreviated as G and the rate of return on capital as R, explains how wealth is accumulated in fewer and fewer hands. His conclusions about capitalism itself, that the natural tendency of the system is to increase inequality ever further, has been the most radical part of his argument. While he was in the U.S. in April, Piketty did not grant many interviews, but I had the good fortune to talk to him for almost an hour. I began by asking him to describe the argument at the center of the book about economic growth and the income that's generated by returns to capital investment.
The book is primarily a book about the history of income and wealth, and you know, there's a little bit of economic theory in it as well, but you know, we should not overestimate, you know, the importance and the ability of theory to understand what is really a multidimensional history of capital and income. But if we want to summarize things in a very simple way, the two important concepts are indeed the rate of return on capital investment and the growth rate. And one of the important tendency in the long run, which I highlight in the book, is the tendency for rate of return to capital to exceed economic growth rate in the very long run. Now, to really understand what this means and what this inequality between R and G, the rate of return and the growth rate, means, it's actually useful, I think, to go back through time and to start by looking at the case of, you know, pre-industrial, you know, agrarian societies, which, you know, in these societies, it was really obvious, I think, to everyone that R was bigger than G. So people would not say it this way, but everybody was aware of that, simply because the growth rate was close to zero. You know, there was almost no population growth, and productivity growth was also very small. Now, the rate of return on capital was certainly not close to zero. It was, you know, if you take land, which was one of the primary assets in those societies, the typical rate of return would be 4 or 5% per year, which would correspond to the fact that, you know, if you want a £1,000 annual income from your land, then you have to have a land value of about £20,000. And, you know, anyone reading novels by Jane Austen or, you know, whatever novel talking about, you know, the landed elite knows this very well, you know, and the novelists don't even have to explain, you know, the notion of a rate of return of 4 or 5%, because everybody knows, you know, how to go from the stock of capital to the flow of income. And this is so important for people's life, you know, who they're going to marry with, what they're going to do with their life, what kind of living standards would they have, that everybody knows this. So in a way, R bigger than G was the foundation of society at that time, because this is what allowed a group of landowners or, you know, owners of whatever assets they were to own to live off their assets. And so that, you know, they don't have to care about their survival and they can devote their time to other activities, science, artistic activities, or, you know, going to the ballroom, or, you know, doing war or government or whatever. And one of the points of my book is to try to make people realize that this obvious truth about pre-industrial societies are bigger than G, you know, did not change all that much because of the Industrial Revolution. You know, of course, the growth rate increased because of the Industrial Revolution. But, you know, in the very long run, the productivity growth rate is usually not larger than 1.5%. So, you know, that's not going to close the gap with the rate of return, especially because with, you know, industrial investment, new forms of capital equipment, you know, new machinery in the 19th century or new robots today, the rate of return can actually increase a little bit from 4, 5 to 6, 7% for some forms of assets. So the gap R minus G between the rate of return and the growth rate is actually not very different in the 19th century or today than what it was in pre-industrial societies. And it's only due to very unusual circumstances during the 20th century that this inequality between R and G was reversed or at least attenuated during such a long time period that we sort of forgot about it. And my book, in a way, is trying to put this at the, you know, forefront of our thinking and inequality dynamics.
So you're saying that on the one hand, over the last several centuries, the rate of return on capital has averaged around 4 or 5%, whereas the rate of economic growth has averaged around, what, 1 or 2%? Is that right?
Yes, 1.5%. At the world level, since the Industrial Revolution, world output has increased at an average rate of 1.6% per year, you know, according to the best estimates we have. You know, maybe it's 1.5, 1.4, you know, where the order of magnitude is this. And it's interesting to see that half of it is actually population growth. That's about 0.8% per year at the world level over the past three centuries. And the other half is per capita GDP growth, so productivity growth. Now, this can seem very small because, you know, sometime, you know, in the post-war, in the post-World War II period, we were sort of all accustomed in developed countries to very high growth rates, you know, in
sure.
Continental Europe, 4-5% per year, or today with China, you know, it's even larger. But this is not what you have in the long run at the world level. You know, you have this kind of very high growth rate only in reconstruction period or when a country is catching up with other countries. But, you know, when you are at the world frontier, and if you take the world as a whole, what you have is 1.6% over three centuries, including half for population, half for productivity. And that was enough, you know, to make 0.8% per year for population was enough to multiply the world population by 10, you know, from 600 million in the 18th century to 7 billion today. So are we going to multiply it by 10 again in the next two centuries? You know, maybe not, probably not. So it's important to get accustomed to the fact that 1% per year for a growth rate is already very rapid, and it would be an illusion, you know, just to wait for, you know, higher growth rate, 4-5% growth rate as a solution to our problems.
So I wonder if you could then spell out explicitly how having this very different rate of return to capital investment versus economic growth, how does that affect wealth inequality?
Okay, so when the rate of return is higher than the growth rate, so for instance, you know, if the rate of return is 5% and the growth rate is only 1%, you know, what this means is that if you start with some wealth, you know, it's easier to grow, whereas if you start with zero wealth, it's more difficult to enter the game. So if you start with some wealth, for instance, all what you need is to reinvest one-fifth of the return to your wealth, so 20%, and you can consume the other four-fifths, 80%, you know, assuming there's no tax, to simplify, so that will be enough. You know, reinvesting one-fifth will be enough to make your wealth grow at 1% per year. so that you will keep the same relative position relative to society. Now, if you reinvest more than that, you will rise in the hierarchy of your time, and you know, if you consume more, you will decline. But this is, in a way, this is a very easy life, you know, for those who start with some initial wealth, because you know, you only need to reinvest a small part. And the extreme case is when the growth rate is equal to zero, you know, in pre-industrial society, where you can just consume all the return to your wealth. Now, when you have a growth rate of 1% and a rate of return of 5%, it's not that different. You know, you just need to reinvest 1/5 and consume the other 4/5. So this tends to push for very high concentration and perpetuation of wealth inequalities. So at the same time, you have innovation, you know, because a growth rate of 1%, this is not a stagnant society. You know, this is a society with a lot of growth. But that's not sufficient to change this basic logic that tends to push toward very high concentration of wealth.
Well, let's talk concretely about the 20th century. And in fact, I want to start with the recent past and then ask you about an earlier period. But since the 1970s, more or less, for the advanced industrial countries, certainly for the United States, economic growth has slowed. And yet the concentration of wealth has increased. So one might think, well, if economic growth slows, shouldn't the rate of return to capital investment also slow? And shouldn't inequality decrease rather than increasing? You argue, of course, and the statistics point out that inequality has increased during this period. So how do we understand that?
The way to understand that is that you know, the growth rate and the rate of return are really determined by almost completely different forces, and they have really no reason to coincide, or they have no reason to decline by the same amount. So it could be that the rate of return also tends to decline when the growth rate declines, but it does not have to decline as much. And more generally, you know, it's important to realize that these two notions are not directly related to one another. You know, the growth rate is determined by the growth of population, so how many children we have. It's determined by productivity growth, so how many inventions we make each year. The rate of return is determined, you know, partly by new inventions that make new equipment more profitable. But even in the absence of new inventions, you know, the rate of return to capital can be quite large and certainly positive, even in a zero growth economy, simply because capital is useful for production. So, you know, having one more acre of land, or having one more piece of tools or equipment, or one more building to stay, you know, that's just useful per se. So the return to capital, you know, simply basically comes from that. And then, you know, the balance of power between capital owners and workers can influence, you know, this rate of return, and it's sometimes the owners of capital are able to push it above, you know, the marginal product of capital, so how useful it is for output. But, you know, even if that was not the case, just the very fact that capital is useful for output makes its return, you know, positive. And this really does not have, even if population growth declines, you know, that's not making capital less useful. You know, so the return to capital doesn't have to decline, or if it does, it certainly doesn't have to decline as much as the population growth decline.
Okay, so your work is taking the long view of the way these processes play out over decades, in fact, over centuries. How would you describe the trajectory for the advanced industrial countries of the 20th century in terms of inequality and the rate of return on capital?
So we observe in every industrialized country a sharp decline in income and wealth inequality between 1910 and 1950, during the first half of the 20th century. And, you know, the first book and research to to point this out was the work by Kuznets in the 1950s in the US, which was really the first important historical work on inequality measurement.
And this is Simon Kuznets.
Simon Kuznets, yes, Ukrainian born but US economist, who computed the first national accounts for the US, the first GDP estimates, and then who started using the income tax data. So the federal income tax had been created in 1913. So starting with this, you have data on income. You know, it's important to realize that the taxation is always more than taxation. It's also a way to produce information, to produce legal categories, statistical categories, democratic transparency and accountability. And so starting with the creation of the federal income tax in 1913, there is data on income. So Kuznets used this data and computed the evolution of the share of national income going to the 10% income earners in the US. And he found this important decline between 1910 and 1950. Now, what we've added to that is to collect the same kind of data for over 30 countries instead of one. And also we added another half century to the Kuznets series, which completely reversed the picture. Because what you can see when you put all this data together, and you know that's really the primary objective of this book, is to put this evidence together so that, you know, everybody can access it and everybody can, you know, make their own mind about these important evolutions. I think everybody, you know, looking at the data will see that the decline of inequality in the US and in other industrialized nations in the first half of the 20th century was largely due to the wars, to World War I, the Great Depression, World War II. So why was it so? Well, simply because there was a big reduction in inequalities of wealth that was brought by war destructions, inflation, bankruptcy during the Great Depression, taxation, you know, huge increase in taxation largely to finance for the war. So that, you know, in 1950, the inequality of property and the inequality in asset income in all those nations was much, much less than in 1910. So the wars did two things. You know, they reduced drastically the rate of return to private capital between 1914 to 1945. So actually for many asset holders, the rate of return was negative. You know, those who have destructions or bankruptcy or, you know, inflation destroyed some of the savings that was put in public debt. And overall, the rate of return was very close to zero for all assets over this period. And then the other effect of these war shocks was to induce a sharp change in policy. So, you know, in the aftermath of World War I and even more so in the aftermath of World War II, you know, sharply progressive taxation was put in place. You know, in a number of countries, you had, sharp regulation of the financial sector, in some countries, and nationalization, rent control. So you had a whole set of policies that sort of reinforced this decline in inequalities that took place during this period.
Responses to the dislocation of war, that the populations, in some sense, had expectations of things being different, and hence there were these new policies that would have been somewhat inconceivable without the dislocation, the chaos of the wars themselves.
Yeah, well, it's very difficult to rewrite history without without the wars. But, you know, I think certainly in Europe, for the U.S. political history of the time, maybe there are reasons to have an interpretation that is a bit more optimistic. But for the European evolutions, you know, I think it's fair to say that, you know, the political system prior to World War I was not really responding to the very high inequality and high concentration of wealth. And it's only after the war and after the Bolshevik Revolution, which also, you know, used certainly served the role as a sort of counter model. And you can see, political parties in the early 1920s, you know, in France or in Britain, who actually rejected the progressive income tax in 1914 and who suddenly think, well, after all, maybe this is less dangerous than the Bolshevik Revolution, and who start supporting progressive taxation. So this large shocks had a huge impact. I guess also after the Great Depression and World War II, you know, many felt both in the US and in Europe that, you know, the financial and economic elites had failed. You know, their incomes and wealth were very high in the 1910s or 1920s, and still, you know, the world economy went into you know, huge crisis in the 30s, which eventually led to World War II and led to cataclysmic shocks of the World War. So of course, in 1945, there's very strong push toward this strong intervention in the economy, strong regulation, and this played a very large role in, you know, to make this reduction in inequality more permanent. Also, the very fast post-war growth, due partly to the reconstruction and the recovery, completely change this balance between the rate of return and the growth rate. So, you know, in the 50s, 60s, 70s, if you have a growth rate of 3, 4, 5% per year, you know, this means that even if you start with no wealth, you can actually, you know, accumulate wealth by your own, and you don't have this big advantage of initial wealth holders that you have in an economy where the growth rate is only 1% and the rate of return is 4-5%. So this very large post-war growth made it easier to have more wealth mobility and to renew, you know, the composition of you know, who's a wealth holder and who's not.
You're listening to Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. My name is Sasha Lilly, and I'm talking with Thomas Piketty. He is an economist and author of the book Capital in the 21st Century, published by Harvard University Press. So this period that you were just describing following World War II, where you had unusually high rates of economic growth and decreased inequality over that period, many people hearken back now to that period as a time that we should return to. However, it seems like from the argument that you are making that over the long view, the natural tendency, if one can put it in those terms, is not for situations like that period. You're saying that's exceptional, that the kind of natural tendency is towards greater and greater inequality.
Well, greater and greater inequality, you know, this has to stop somewhere. But what I am saying is that this somewhere can be indeed naturally pretty high, because with a low growth rate and rate of return to capital that's substantially and permanently higher to the growth rate, then indeed wealth inequalities tend to rise toward a very high level. So they don't rise forever, you know, because it always happens, you know, in the life of a family wealth, and, you know, someone is going to dilapidate the wealth, or someone is going to give it away, or someone is going to have too many children or too few children, or, you know, things happen that make you always have some mobility in the distribution of wealth. But you will tend to converge, you know, with high rate of return and low growth to a level of wealth concentration that's naturally very large, and apparently much larger than what we already have today, in the sense that if we look at the recent decades, you know, the top of the distribution of wealth has been rising, you know, much faster, typically three times faster than the size of the economy in the US or even in Europe or at the world level. So this is sort of clear, concrete evidence of this idea that the rate of return to capital, at least for large portfolio, is higher than the rate of growth. And this is clear evidence that we are moving toward a rising concentration of wealth. I don't know if the post-war period was an anomaly, but, you know, it was largely the consequence of the war itself, of World War I, World War II. So, you know, we don't have to be nostalgic about that, because, you know, it's, you know, we don't want to return to 1950 with, you know, after a long sequence of 30 years of wars and depression and destruction in Europe and Japan. And so, you know, we have to find other ways. We have to find more, sustainable and peaceful way to regulate this process.
Well, speaking about wealth inequality in the United States,
particularly, which has really mushroomed over the last decades. Would you say that the dynamic that you're describing to do with returns to capital explains that kind of accelerated wealth inequality in the U.S., or are there other factors that we should also be considering?
There are other factors. So particularly in the U.S., the rise of very top managerial compensation has played an important role. And this is not directly related to the inequality between rate of return and growth rate. So, you know, there are several processes that are sort of accumulating their effect. Now, the book is trying to shift the attention from, you know, rising top incomes to rising top wealth, because I believe in the very long run, the dynamics of wealth concentration are even more important and have deeper consequences for, you know, the working of our political institutions and the entire social fabric than just the rise of top income. But in the U.S., this is less true in Europe, but in the U.S., you really have the two processes together. You have the wealth process and you have the rise of very top managerial compensation, which, you know, some people argue that at least this allows some individuals to accumulate a lot of wealth without starting with a lot of wealth. Now, the problem is of course, for everybody who is neither a top manager or a top wealth holder, then you lose on both grounds. And it's not clear at all that the mass of the people actually benefit from this rising top managerial compensation. You know, if you take the United States since 1980, you have rising inequality everywhere except in the growth statistics. You know, the performance of the U.S. economy in terms of per capita GDP growth has not been particularly good since 1980, with a growth rate of around 1.5% per year in per capita terms. So if you take two-thirds or three-quarters of that to the top 1%, you know, that's not a good deal for the rest of the population. So and evidence, you know, both international evidence and historical evidence and company level evidence, you know, suggests that, you know, you could have the same growth rate without such a big share of the growth going to top managers.
What has happened with the dynamics that you're describing following the financial crisis that started in 2007, 2008? What have we seen in that period in terms of growth and in terms of capital accumulation?
You know, initially there was, in 2008, 2009, you know, because of the stock market crash, you know, there was a decline in large bonuses and large capital gains. So the, you know, very top incomes did decline. But then a few years down the road, the process of rising inequality and rising top incomes, in fact, started again. And, you know, the latest estimates that we have put online with my colleague Emmanuel Saez, who teaches at Berkeley University, is that, you know, the share of U.S. national income going to the top 10% is now above 50%, you know, in 2012, which was the latest data point we have. And this is actually higher than in 2007. So, you know, initially this declined a little bit in 2008-9, and then starting in 2010-11-12, this started rising again. So that in the end, the long run trend toward rising inequality certainly doesn't seem over. You know, so how far this is going to go, it's very difficult to say. But it one has to be aware of the fact that the magnitude of the trend is really enormous. So the share of U.S. national income going to the top 10% used to be 30-35% back in the 70s. Now it's above 50%. So is that going to be 60%? 20 years from now, 70%, you know, some people seem to believe that wherever it goes, you know, we'll be fine. But, you know, at some point, you have to look at the numbers, and the numbers are really quite big. And there's really no evidence suggesting that the financial crisis per se is going to alter the trend and is going to change the trend. So, after the Great Depression, what really changed the trends was not so much the Great Depression per se, but the new policy regime and the new institutions, the new fiscal institutions, social institutions, regulatory institutions that were adopted in the aftermath of the Great Depression and World War II.
Sure. So, in fact, during a crisis, it seems like the opportunity for those in power to force down the wages of workers is actually higher. And what would be significant about the Great Depression is that it was then followed by a wave of social movements that made radical demands. And in many ways, there was a political response institutionally to that. Although we've had some social protest in this country, certainly with the Occupy movement, mm-hmm. there really hasn't been anything comparable that would have that kind of force to make people in power uneasy enough that they feel they need to redistribute wealth.
Yeah, I certainly agree with that. You know, I think one problem is that it's as if the only lessons we have remembered from the Great Depression is that we need a good central bank, you know, not to let the financial systems go bankrupt. And you know, indeed, we need a good central bank, but, you know, that's not enough. And we're asking too much to central banking right now, you know, because, you know, the Federal Reserve in the U.S. and the European Central Bank are able to print, you know, as many billions of dollars and euros that as they want, and they can lend them to whoever they want. And, you know, in a way, that's much easier than a tax system where, you know, you have to write the tax code, you have to write the tax base, and, you know, it takes years and it takes a parliament and it takes political discussion. But on the other hand,
it takes angering a lot of people.
But at least we know what we do after with the tax system. Whereas, you know, when you print all these billions and you lend them to whoever you want, you know, sometimes central banks don't really know what they are doing. And you know, you can't ask central banks to solve all the problems we have to solve. You know, we need social institutions, we need minimum wages, we need progressive taxation, we need unions, we need educational institutions. And it's as if, Milton Friedman wrote this book, The Monetary History of the United States, you know, in the 19, which had a huge impact in the 1970s and 1980s. And basically, the message of the book was all what we need is a good Federal Reserve Bank. You know, the welfare state is useless. And in fact, all what went wrong during the Great Depression was that we didn't have the proper Federal Reserve. Now, it's as if we are now applying this lesson, and which I think is a misreading of history. You know, yes, we need a good Federal Reserve, but we also need a good welfare state, and we also need a good tax system and a good educational system. You know, I think people now are starting to realize, but, you know, that just printing, billions of dollars and euros, you know, it's not going to be enough to solve the problem. You know, this was enough to sort of avoid transforming the recession into a depression. You know, this was enough to at least it was probably better to avoid, you know, a lot of bankruptcy, chain bankruptcy in financial system to happen, which you know, was a disaster in the 1930s. But, you know, again, that's not enough. And I think we need this, intellectual and historical debate about, you know, the sort of these lessons of history and what really happened to income and wealth dynamics, and what was the roles of these different institutions in the past, if we want to look at the future.
You're listening to Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. My name is Sasha Lilly, and today I'm joined by Thomas Piketty. He is professor at the Paris School of Economics and author of Capital in the 21st Century, Looking at Wealth Inequality. That's published by Harvard University Press. Let me ask you about countries that are outside of the advanced industrial countries. These trends that you've been describing in terms of growing wealth inequality, do they apply equally to the countries of the global south, the third world, as they do to the first world, or does the dynamic take a different form?
I think eventually they will apply as well, and to some extent they already apply. But of course, there are important differences. So right now, emerging countries like China, you know, are growing very fast, and this is you know, the growth rate in such countries can be a lot larger than the rate of return to capital, or at least than the safe rate of return to capital. So they don't have the problems they have to solve are different from ours. But you know, at some point they will growth rate of 10% or 5% per year are not going to continue forever. So you know, at some point they will have to face growth slowdown, and then they will enter into the same kind of dilemma and difficulties that we are having right now. And to some extent, they already are. You know, if you the rise of a wealthy oligarchy, you know, is certainly something you see in Russia or China or, you know, other emerging countries. And, you know, the way they deal with it is mostly on a sort of case-by-case basis. You know, you let enormous wealth accumulation happen, and then suddenly you decide that, you know, if someone wants to do politics, you put him in jail, or, you know, if you feel that the public opinion in some area in China is just too angry, then you expropriate him. But, you know, I think this case-by-case approach is just not working, and I think some of the Chinese elite is starting to realize that. And, you know, in fact, you know, I was at a conference in Hong Kong last fall on changing distribution of wealth and issues of property taxation in China, and they are seriously thinking about introducing forms of property taxation and progressive taxation of wealth. And you know, it could be that some of the innovations will come from these countries, because you know, the sort of more centralized nature of the country will you know, might make it easier. You know, on the other hand, this will be a major loss of power for the political elite, because you know, when you deal with wealth on a case by case basis, you know, you keep a lot of power for yourself, which you lose with the tax system. Because the tax system, you know, you have to set the rules in advance, and then you know, this is the rule of law. Then, you know, it's unclear whether the Chinese elites want this at this stage. But in any case, these are world problems. These are world challenges, not only for the rich countries. And you know, we are going to see more and more of that in the future.
I know you're an economist rather than an oracle, but do you see that as wealth inequality, given that there's a tendency for it to increase, that concerns around social unrest, like in a country like China, will continue to grow?
Yeah, as you said, you know, I'm better at analyzing the past than the future. So, you know, ultimately, the objective of the book is not to, you know, it's not to make predictions, but rather to help everybody, you know, to make their own mind. And, you know, I think, you know, there are several possible futures. You know, it ultimately depends on the policies and institutions that we collectively choose, and on you know, our ability to, you know, to have mass mobilization on these issues and develop the right, you know, organization and institution and diffuse knowledge. And, you know, it's in a way, you know, in the both Marx and Kuznets were wrong. You know, Marx sort of believes that there will be a falling rate of profit will put an end to this process, and Kuznets, from a completely opposite view, you sort of believe also in sort of deterministic economic forces which will make inequality go down, naturally reduce in the advanced stages of development. I think both were wrong in the sense that I, from a purely economic viewpoint, there's no natural force that should dominate one another. You know, it really depends on you know, the political institutions that we choose, and it depends on, you know, the ability of the elite to persuade you know, others that you know, this level of inequality or this you know, this form of distribution is acceptable and is in the common interest or not. So, you know, I want to be optimistic, because I think, you know, the diffusion of information today, you know, hopefully can be you know, sufficient to sort of develop the kind of you know, mobilization and political reactions that we need. You know, if you look at the past, I guess one century ago, you know, around 1900-1910, many people in the US would have said that the, you know, the federal income tax would never exist, and, you know, the Constitution made it impossible to exist. And, you know, in the end, things happen. You know, sometimes you don't. So I'm not, I'm not terribly impressed by those who know in advance, what will or will not happen, and who know in advance that, no political reaction will happen. You know, I think, things happen sometimes faster than we think.
Well, you just mentioned Marx, and I would like to ask you a bit more about what you draw from, if anything, from him, and where do you part ways? Because, of course, the title of your book evokes, more than anything else, his masterwork.
Yeah, of course, these are very different books. You know, this was Marx's book was 150 years ago, so, it's a completely different context. And I guess the present book is called Capital in the 21st Century, and the purpose is really to put capital into history and to put the study of capital into an historical perspective. So this is mostly a book about history, whereas the book by Marx, included, limited empirical evidence and lot of, purely theoretical speculation. So I guess the common point is that Marx was certainly very concerned about rising inequality, at the time of the Industrial Revolution. And, I think, indeed, you have a almost complete stagnation of wages in Britain or France between 1800 and 1870. And in spite of the very large economic growth, you have a rise in the capital share and stagnating wage income with, children, under the age of eight working in mines, etc. So, Marx was very concerned about that, was trying to analyze how such a system was going to evolve in the future. At least the good thing is that he was concerned about a very important fact and evolution, and he was trying to explain it. And I think some economists today tend to forget these lessons, that we should start from important facts around us and try to explain them and try to see what can be done about this evolution. Now, Marx or other 19th century economists were asking the right questions, some of the right questions. Now, they were not always giving the right answers. And in particular, Marx had this big conclusion about the falling rate of profit, which was basically saying that the rate of return to capital, this is really the same concept as the rate of return, should fall toward zero. And therefore, there will be sort of a final war or revolution, and there will be an end to the process. Capitalists somehow dig their own grave, and this will put an end to the process. Now, my conclusions in that sense are very different, because my conclusion is that the rate of return is bigger than the growth rate and can be bigger than the growth rate forever. So there's no natural end to the process. There's no economic force that should bring this process down. So in that sense, the conclusion is very different.
Economist Thomas Piketty is my guest. He's the author of the book Capital in the 21st Century, published by Harvard University Press. You're listening to Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio, and my name is Sasha Lilly. Well, you start the book, and I want to turn the conversation to your own profession. You start the book by revisiting a number of political economists, including Marx, and their attempts in the 19th century to come to terms with inequality and these sort of big questions about how society is structured. The economics profession in our time has, in many ways, avoided a lot of those big questions, and certainly taking the long view as you've done, looking at economic history, has not been the dominant way that economists have gone about their business. What are your concerns about your own profession in terms of trying to get a handle on these questions, trying to understand these profound questions about economics?
Well, I'm trying with this book to put back the study of distribution at the heart of economic analysis, which to some extent it was in the 19th century. I guess What has gone wrong in some ways is probably the boundaries between disciplines within the social sciences have become too sharp. You know, I think one reason why this work was not done before is that in a way it was too historical for economists and also too economic for historians. So, you know, nobody was collecting this historical data on income and wealth. And you know, what I've done is very, you know, basic in a way, and just, you know, the data was sitting there, and, you know, it's a bit tedious to collect it. It takes time, but, you know, there's nothing particularly, you know, deep or clever in doing that. And this was not done just before because of sharp boundaries. And, you know, I view myself more as a social scientist than as an economist. You know, I think, you know, it's very convenient for economists, you know, to define themselves as very different from, you know, sociologists and historians. And sometimes it's also convenient for historians and sociologists and anthropologists to define themselves as different from economists. You know, it's useful to have very sharp identities, and it helps you, you know, find your way in life. But, you know, sometimes it's just a big loss of time, because in the social sciences, we just know too little in each discipline to, you know, divide ourselves in such strong manner. You know, when you study the structure of social classes and income groups and wealth groups, you know, I think you need to be pragmatic about your methods and sources, and, you know, you have to do history as much as economics and political science. And yeah, I think economists lose too much energy just trying to differentiate themselves from other disciplines. Typically, they use a lot of excessively complicated mathematics just to look different and to look more scientific. You know, that's an easy way to look scientific, is if you use complicated math, you look serious, you know. But sometimes it's just a way to dissimulate, the fact that you actually don't have much to say about a problem, and just to look, you look very sophisticated, when in fact, you know, the actual content of what you have is limited. So, you know, I think, you know, math can be useful when it's simple, and I use a few equations in my book because I think they are useful to account for a large body of evidence. But too often, the economists tend to do the opposite. You know, they have a very, very small body of evidence, and they use incredibly complicated math. So I think what good thing about being an economist or a social scientist in France is that the economist profession doesn't have much prestige in France, and, you know, the economists are not taken very seriously by historians or sociologists or politicians or bankers or whoever. In fact, so it's actually stimulating, because, you know, it forces you to try to be convincing and see, you know, what evidence and what do you have to bring, really. You know, you cannot just pretend to be smarter than everyone else, which is the usual attitude of a number of economists in this country.
Why is it that economists have tended to focus, unlike you've done in the book, on earned income, on wages, rather than on income from capital, when they've looked at inequality? That seems to be one of the differences and one of the innovations, perhaps, of your book. But one would imagine that actually focusing on wealth would be an important dimension of any questions around inequality.
I think there's been two illusions as to which can explain, you know, the sort of limited attention to capital income and inequality in capital ownership and wealth. One illusion is the idea that with the rise of human capital, financial wealth, real estate wealth, you know, does not matter anymore. All what matters is human capital. Now, I think this is largely an illusion, because, in fact, of course, you have a rise of human capital, you have a rise of human skills, but you have also a rise of non-human capital assets. You know, you have much more equipment, machinery, buildings, patents, computers than you had before. So in the end, the ratio between the two, you know, the capital share in national income and the labor share in national income, in the very long run, you know, you have no tendency of human capital to replace non-human capital. So that's the first illusion, you know, the rise of human capital. The other important illusion is the view that with aging, capital ownership becomes almost exclusively related to life cycle wealth accumulation. So you know, the story will be, you know, with aging and aging population, now everyone starts poor as when you're young, and then you accumulate wealth for your old days, and then you consume your wealth when you're old, and that's it. So that will be a model where, if you want, you know, the war of ages has completely replaced the class war. So you don't have inequality anymore within a given age group. It's only just, you know, everybody becomes rich when you get older, and which is now, you know, as all illusions, this is partly true, but you know, this is much less true than what we sometimes imagine. So in practice, what you observe is that wealth inequality within age group is actually almost as large as wealth inequality over the entire population. So it's simply wrong that, you know, wealth has become just an age issue. You know, there's true, we have aging, we have, you know, the age dimension of wealth has become more important over time, but it has not replaced, you know, the class dimension, if you wish, and the within age group inequality of wealth. But I think these are the sort of the two illusions that probably explain the lesser attention given to wealth inequality and capital income for a very long time.
Finally, let me end by asking you whether you have any expectation, at least, that putting aside the impact of this book on the general public, do you have any indication that the economics profession may be taking into account this different approach and we might see some shifts in terms of the ways that people do economics?
Well, I'm afraid it's a bit too early to say. You know, I'm certainly trying hard to try to, you know, to push the profession in this direction. And, you know, I think to some extent the profession is now doing, you know, it's taking distribution and inequality more seriously today than it used to 10 years or 20 years ago. So, you know, you have places like, you know, at Berkeley, the Center for Equitable Growth, led by Emmanuel Saez, you know, is trying to take this issue of, you know, equitable growth and inequality at the forefront. But, you know, I think it will take time. And I think it will take not only economists to change, you know, the way they look at these issues, but also, you know, other social scientists, you know, should not let the study of this economic issues to economists. You know, I think everybody should care about income and wealth and unemployment. And, you know, putting together numbers and theories is certainly not the only way to do social science research, but this is one of the important ways. You know, we should take money seriously. You know, for a long time, you know, historians and sociologists were taking this as more seriously maybe than they now do. And, you know, I think, you know, everybody has a sort of, you know, responsibility here. And, you know, these are not, you know, it's convenient for economists to pretend that they have an incredible knowledge and science and ability to understand these things that others don't. But it's also convenient for others, you know, to say, okay, I don't know anything about economics, I don't have an opinion. No, you have to have an opinion. Everybody has to have an opinion. You know, it's too easy just to leave it to economists.
Thomas Piketty, thank you so much for your time.
Thank you.
Thomas Piketty has been my guest. He's the author of the best-selling Capital in the 21st Century. That's published by Harvard University Press. And he teaches at the Paris School of Economics. You've been listening to Against the Grain. My name is Sasha Lilly. Thanks so much for listening. And please tune in again next time. Against the Grain is produced by Sasha Lilly and C.F. Song. Please visit us online at againstthegrain.org, where you'll find on-demand and downloadable audio and a way to sign up for our podcast. And check us out on Facebook at Against the Grain Radio.